conversation with our friend Dr. Ron Daniels. He is back for the hour with some updates on reparations and the movement there. Of course, we sit in California. Where we are making some progress, if I can put that, I'm putting that in air quotes. I think it's progress. We shall see. But the nation is watching us here in California to see what we're going to do on this issue of reparations. We'll talk about that. We will talk about, in this hour, the historic campaign of Jesse Jackson in 84. Hard to believe it's been 40 years, but 40 years since that historic campaign of Jesse Jackson in his race for the White House. We'll get his reflections and thoughts on that 4 decades later. But I want to start our conversation talking about Haiti. Remember Haiti? and all the drama that's happening on that tiny island nation. I say that in part because the news cycle is interesting. We've been spending so much time, obviously, as we should, of late, talking about Israel and Hamas. We, of course, are talking about Russia and Ukraine. We are certainly talking about the Trump trial, trials plural, but certainly the one that's ongoing right now in New York City. And in the midst of all that, sometimes we take our eye off the ball and we lose sight of things that we ought to be tracking. Thankfully, there are people, when the rest of us are focusing on other things, who are tracking these other issues that matter just as much. And that's why you talk to a guy like Ron Daniels. Dr. Ron Daniels, how are you today, sir?
Well, I'm blessed, stressed, and blessed. I'm stressed and stretched, but blessed, my brother, to be with you. And when I listened to the station, I said, oh, my goodness. You know, Black Talk Radio still matters. I know social media is important and all that good stuff, but to listen to how you rocking and rolling with KBLA and the Black Information Network, it just soothes my soul, and want to congratulate you on, you know, continue to push forward with your dream and your vision. And it's really, really wonderful, my brother. So, you know, we do what we have to do. And so I'm saying, you know, it is stressful. It is, I'm stretched out, but yeah. I am blessed.
Yeah.
I'm blessed to be able to have the experience and longevity and, you know, and relationships to live a life that matters.
Yep. You said it, so I'm going to follow you. Let me start by saying thank you, first of all, for those kind words. It means a great deal to me, particularly coming from one of your stature. And of your substance, I appreciate that. So thank you for those kind words. Let me start here again. Since you went there first, I want to follow you. And this is a question that I've asked in a variety of ways. Oftentimes, this comes up at the end of conversations, after I've heard the thesis of whoever the guest may be in that particular hour. But I want to ask you this question on the front side, not the back side, given what you've already said about being blessed, but also stressed about your longevity. You're now, what, 81, 82 years of age now. You've lived a long life. You've seen a lot. You're still on the front lines of this struggle. And I'm curious as to how, in this particular moment, you are sustaining your hope.
Well, I sustain my hope because I've always been optimistic and hopeful. It's like Reverend Jesse Jackson says, keep hope alive. But that's not a that's an interesting slogan, because if you don't have hope, people are hopeless people are not a people who struggle. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you people are down and out and they don't have hope, they don't struggle. And I'm sure like you, I'm just inspired by my ancestors. That has always been what drives me. And quite frankly, I see this as a calling. Mm. You know, I'm not a minister. I'm not a, you know, I don't have that kind of calling, though in a sense it is, it's a kind of layperson's calling, and it's rooted in my life in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, when my mother was, you know, struggling as a single mom to raise, you know, 4 children in August Wilson's Hill District. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, it was tough, man. And I looked up in the sky one night and said, look, people ought not to live like this. And ever since that, I mean, I really believe this is a calling. So when I say I'm stressed, it is. It's difficult. But I'm blessed. And I enjoy, I relish what I do, because I think that the work that we put in, you know, really does, you know, have impact and matter. The other thing is, yes, I'll be in a week from this coming Friday, I will be celebrating my 82nd birthday. I'm vigorous. I'm strong. You know, got some aches and pains and so forth and so on. But I don't really feel no ways tired, to be honest about it.
There you go.
And the other thing is, you know, I have to think about the fact that there are so many of our soldiers who've gone on, and I'm standing in for them. I'm still blessed. Damu Smith is gone. Ron Walters is gone. Sharshi McIntyre. There's so many people. Dr. James Turner. These are people that I've worked with. And so I feel I am representing them. And as long as I'm standing and healthy and whatever, you know, I'll keep on keeping on. I do. I am. We are working on cross-generational transfer of leadership, as we must, because we know there's, you know, I mean, we're not immortal. We will be making our ascension into the ancestor realm. But I don't wake up feeling like I'm tired or I'm finished. You know, I still think I have something to contribute.
Well, indeed you do, and you're going to contribute for the rest of this hour, because I've got questions for you about a number of issues. We will talk about Haiti, of course, when we come forward. But I want to probe just a little bit more. I've known Dr. Ron Dennis for a long time, and I've never actually probed this, but I want to now. And that is a bit more about his growing up in Pittsburgh. He went there before I could even get there. You mentioned Pittsburgh, you have to mention August Wilson. Those two things just go together. If you mention Pittsburgh, you must mention the name of the greatest black playwright ever, August Wilson. But I'm curious to get more of the backstory of his growing up in Pittsburgh in that Hill District during that particular era. And then we'll jump from there for the rest of the hour. I guess Dr. Ron Daniels, you're listening to him right now, and I'm glad about it, on Tavis Smiley.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley.
Ranked number 45 on the Heavy 100 list of the 100 most important radio talk show hosts in America. Let's get back to more of this rich dialogue with Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley and Dr. Ron Daniels, who I'm pleased to have on this program. Before I get to Port-au-Prince, tell me about Pittsburgh. I want to hear more about what it was like for you growing up in the Hill District in Pittsburgh during that era.
Well, you know, as I talk about in my book, still on this mission, the vision and mission of Dr. Ron Daniels, it's a tale of two cities, actually. We really come out of the coal fields of West Virginia, my mother and father, into a steel town called Youngstown, Ohio, was once the fourth largest steel-producing center in the U.S. But unfortunately, at age 9, my mother and father separated, and because we had relatives, particularly an aunt, in Pittsburgh, my mother took us to Pittsburgh, and we landed in the Hill District of Pittsburgh. And at that stage, you know, it's like a lot of these, what we call them, America's dark ghettos. There was an upper hill that was a little better off than the Dora Hill, but we were in the lower hill. And it was rough, brother. I mean, you know, the rats and roaches and, I mean, slum conditions. It was brutal, you know, and to watch my mother grow up, you know, I mean, to watch my mother struggle in that environment. I actually eventually had a nervous breakdown, and we had to, you know, go back. I had to go back to Youngstown and whatever. But the thing that I drew out from that, however, and I always go back. I go back and take my sons and daughters there to like a pilgrimage, because even in as difficult as life was in the Hill District, there were strengths that we know were in our communities. There were no motherless children, no fatherless children, because it did not matter whether the next door neighbor was doing numbers running, was selling booze or whatever the deal was. Mm-hmm. I mean, they all looked after the children in the neighborhood. There was a Hill City. There was a community center. There were several of them, actually, where we could actually go and get some nurturing and some, and you know, it was rough, man. It was difficult. But there were these spaces that cared for us in the neighborhood. And there were teachers, you know, I remember the teachers who just grabbed us and, you know, tried to stimulate and move us forward and whatever. And so even though it was a very, very difficult climate and we lived in poverty, if you will, there were strengths that I reflect on in these neighborhoods and these communities that we kind of miss now. Because we don't, in many instances, have that same kind of connectivity, if you will. So, you know, it was out of that environment. I took the strengths of a Hill City. I took the strengths of having been baptized at age 12, the youngest delegate to the convention in Philadelphia at age 12 and whatever. And got connected with a brother who was in the Marine Corps, came back, and he wanted to give back, created something called a cadet corps. I was drawn to it, took that same concept to Youngstown, Ohio, built an organization that began to show my leadership. I mean, it's just an incredible story, you know, that comes out of these two cities that I grew in and honed the skills that I developed over the years. So in that sense, really, when I think about it, I think about these experiences as why I have to do what I have to do. And I don't, you know, I don't ask anybody else to work as hard as I work or to sacrifice or commit, as Ralph Featherstone would say, in the way I do. I don't indict people at that level. But this is my calling, and it's rooted in these kinds of experiences, and both in Pittsburgh and Youngstown. And by the way, I get the same kind of thing. I've not been lately, but for almost 20-something years, I went to Selma every year to cross that bridge. Because when I cross that bridge, I can feel the ancestors in terms of and the experience of what they had. So that's, again, that's what drives me in terms of the work.
All these years later, I hope I can ask you this, and if it's getting too dicey, or if I'm getting too close, you tell me and I'll back up. But since you raised it, I want to just kind of probe it just for a moment here. All these years later, now that you are about to start your 82nd campaign, when you look back on the nervous breakdown that your mother had, born of the stresses, we started this conversation with you telling me that you're stressed, but you're blessed. And I think many of us can associate with that. We share that sentiment. But when you look back all these years later on the stress and the pressure that your mother was under, that caused her to have a nervous breakdown, the same kind of stress and pressure that black folk under the day. And we still don't take the issue of our mental health as seriously as we ought. But all the, with all these decades in the rear view, what have you thought about? How do you process all the pressure your mother was under doing her best that led her to have a nervous breakdown?
You know, let me just say, you can't get too deep in terms of this, because one of the things I enjoy when I do interviews, and you know, when you and I had an interview, I did the same thing with you. Because it's important for people to understand why we do what we do.
That's right.
You know, it's easy for me to come on talk about Haiti, talk about Grenada, and I mean full blown. But who? I mean, it's important for us to know who Tabitha Smiley is. And I always, my most favorable and gratifying interviews are when I have these kind of conversations. And inevitably, a lot of times, like, we've known each other for a while, but we don't know all that we need to know.
That's right.
So the thing that I've been pleased about in terms of my own, the way my own mind works, is I've been able to look at those experiences in terms of the context of them. Mm-hmm. So really what you're talking about, again, you know, my mother, you know, like so many black women, I mean, she was a proud woman, you know, and again, my mother and father both had strengths. Mm-hmm. But my mother, she was not getting enough child support. Mm-hmm. But she refused to, like, she just wanted to struggle and get it done, right? And so that's talks about the nature of the system that we work under. And there was not sufficient, like you said, benefits in the community that we needed. And as we speak today, despite having a period of time where we did have some mental health facilities and some health facilities, and that's the stigma on mental health has been there for many, many, many years, because we used to talk about sending people to the crazy house and all those kind of things. That infrastructure has been decimated. One of the reasons we have some of the difficulties in our cities today is that many of the people who are homeless, as you well know, and others, they have serious alcohol, addiction issues, mental health issues, and the public space, which is not, this is hyperbole to some degree, the great equalizer in a capitalist political economy, has been decimated. Mm-hmm. And it's been decimated by a calculated, what years people forget, privatization was a drive to take over the public sector. So that's what I take from that. And my mother, you know, she had to make a decision, because there were two children by my biological father and two additional children. She had to make a decision. She went on to Indianapolis, and we had to go back to my brother and I went back to Youngstown. But the other thing about my mother, here's a woman, again, and this is what we've seen in our experiences over and over again. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant mother. She only went to 11th grade. But as she shared stories about the Great Depression, we grew up hearing about those stories. But she also talked about the fact that she went to Washington, D.C. to work in the Federal Mint and what that meant. Mm-hmm. I later on could interpret that to understand that what she was able to do that because A. Philip Randolph had called for the first march on Washington mm-hmm. in 1940-1941. And the Fair Employment Practices Commission that was issued by Roosevelt opened up those public jobs to black people that had not previously been available to them, and one of them was in the Federal Mint, the post office, and my mother was able to take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. So this is how I when I look at these experiences, I know they're personal and they have consequences in that way, but I've been able to sort of draw out and take a broader view and say, what were the policy implications? What was going on that needed to be corrective, or what happened that on an affirmative side? And the same thing quickly with my father. You know, he was, you know, he had his own issues and so forth. My mother always believed much more in me than my father did. Frankly, he was converted later on, mm-hmm. but he was from Georgia. He was a staunch member of the NAACP. Mm. And we would drive from Youngstown, Ohio to Georgia every year, and he would tell stories, and he would talk about it. He'd have that blue steel Smith and Wesson up under the seat, you know, as he drove in. Sure. And we experienced firsthand my father having to ask, "Do you serve Negroes here?" And having to go to the back, you know, to get sandwiches or whatever, all those kind of. He took us in Georgia to a place where one of our relatives was lynched. Mm. He had that experience, and then we were connected really to, you know, a family, the Cook family that produced Dr. Sam Dubose Cook.
Oh yeah,
who's one? And that's my first cousin. Mm. And so anyway, the rich experiences like that I can draw on between these two cities and whatever. And again, mm. that's never far from my mind as I am working with our people. And I really, this whole notion we said back in the day, an undying love for our people, you do have to have that undying love. Mm. And you know that it's difficult. You know there are problems. But I can work past that and keep moving ahead with hope because I know what we've gone through. And that, you know, it's like Martin Luther King said, you know, I may not get there with you, but someday we're going to get to the promised land.
You mentioned your father and his being a staunch member in support of the NAACP. And, of course, out of that experience, while your father was, as you put it, he came to be a late believer, at least in your talents, but he eventually made that turn. But he was a staunch supporter and member of the NAACP, as you mentioned. And here we are now talking to Dr. Ron Daniels, who has, for the balance of his life, been on the front lines of our struggle. And I wonder if I could just ask you, just briefly here, what your critique is in real time. I'm sure you have one. What's your critique in real time of black activism? And I don't want to color that question much more than that, but in this particular moment, with all that we're up against, what's your critique of black activism?
Well, I think you know, it goes in cycles, you know, and we tend to romanticize about back in the day and whatever. We have a new era of activism, and it's being spearheaded, you know, by brilliant, you know, young black leadership, or at least leadership that is a generation or so behind me, certainly. Black Lives Matter and Movement for Black Lives, and certainly just the other day, you know, the announcement on your show, breaking news, that one of the most brilliant leaders that we have, Dr. Malina Abdullah, is going to be the vice presidential candidate for Cornell West. Mm-hmm. So what we have is, you know, a lot of motion, a lot of movement that is taking place that has pushed us, you know, forward. But what I lament at several levels at this stage is a kind of lack of civic education at one level. And let me just say this. I was thinking about you the other day because one of the most valuable services that you performed, and you've done many, and people still remember this, is that you had those incredible town hall meetings that had all across the country. Mm. And the reason why they were important was you didn't just have the town hall meetings. They were designed to elicit from people, engage people, and then to produce a black agenda, which you did. Mm-hmm. the other thing that I kind of lament is I am not happy about what I see as kind of, and this is what we sort of specialize with in the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. This is what my legacy project is. Our mantra is promoting a culture of collaboration. Let me say that again, collaboration to heal and empower Black families, communities, and nations. We still are, Tabas, at this stage, too fragmented in our community. So even though we're active, different organizations, there's little specialization division of labor. We trip over each other doing some of us the same work. And by the way, we don't share information. And I do declare that our adversaries may not be totally unified, but they do share information. They plan ahead. And we sometimes fail by the lack of information. Ignorance is not bliss. It is catastrophic. And so for me, building out, and at the national level, I got to say right now, that's one of my concerns. We are facing one of the most serious crises. It's like, I don't know whether it was Vernon Jordan or somebody said, if America gets a cold, Black America gets pneumonia.
Right.
Well, we're, you know, if we're facing an existential threat from MAGAism and the Orange Man and Agent Orange and all of these white nationalist, white supremacist infected and infused movements that are threatening democracy, the edifice of democracy, then we inevitably are caught up in that. And yet I don't really see at our national level, and I've had some conversation with some of our leaders, I have relationships with almost all of them,
many of them.
That we don't have the Black Leadership Forum anymore. The Black Leadership Forum was a kind of united front where they would meet at least once a month. Walter Fauntroy talked about something called the Black Leadership Roundtable. You may recall it when we used to go to the CBC.
Sure.
He would combine over 200 organizations every year. Mm-hmm. That's not here anymore.
Let me cut you. No, you're doing fine. I want to pause for a second. Up against the clock here. When we come forward, though, I want to really this is getting good, as we say around here. I want to probe at least two of these laments that you've just laid out a little more deeply. The lament of civic education or the lack thereof, and the lament of lack of collaboration amongst Black people and certainly Black leadership. There's something there that I want to interrogate when we come forward. We ain't got to Haiti yet. You never know how these conversations are going to go. I just go with the flow. You're listening to Tavis Smith.
Seeking the truth. Speaking the truth. This is the Tavis Smiley Show. Sounds different, huh? This is Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley in conversation with Dr. Ron Daniels. In this hour, we're spending some time in the, in the Elder's Skybox. Sometimes you want to just take a seat for a little while. In the Elder's Skybox and listen to some wisdom speaking. That's what we're hearing in this hour. He's about to start his 82nd campaign. And that is a blessing, well beyond the 310 he was promised. So he's on borrowed time, but he's making the most of it. He said earlier he's stressed, but he's also blessed. More importantly, he continues to engage the working witness that I've known him to engage for decades now. And so we're going to stay up here in this Elder Skybox for the rest of the hour and learn what we can from one of our noted elders. So I asked you a few minutes ago what your critique was at this point in your life. Or is at this point in your life of Black activism, and you started out and giving me an answer, and then you pivoted and said, now Tavis, having said that, there are at least a couple of laments that I have vis-a-vis Black activism, and one of those laments was a lack of civic education, and the other is a lack of collaboration. I want to take them one at a time. Unpack for me more deeply your lament about our lack of civic education and what you precisely mean by that.
Well, first of all, let me lay one more quickly on the table, and that
sure.
is one of the things that, because I tend to be somebody who believes in, who does not believe in either or. I believe in both and.
Right.
And I also think that we're beginning to bridge it some now. But once social media hit, there was, I think, in the young generation, a kind of obsession, and understandably so, with the effectiveness that you could of social media, particularly in terms of controlling your own productivity and
sure,
whatever.
Sure.
But there's no substitute. This is why when I mentioned earlier, I was intentional about saying, but there's some people who still listen to radio. You know what I mean? And so we have to synchronize. We have to use both radio and social media. And in a very, very, I think, profound kind of way, there is really no substitute for actual human interaction with each other.
Right.
And so in some way, you use social media in order to galvanize people to do the social interaction. That's one of the things that I mean.
Right.
And I think this young generation itself is well educated. It's engaged in many ways, but there's a way in which the cross generational kind of transfer of information has not been as effective as it could be. Mm-hmm. But I'm getting to very basic kinds of things. And I was having a conversation the other day, and, you know, I mean, education has progressed and so forth and so on. But back in the day, there was something as simple as civics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we used to have civics. I mean, that taught basic elementary, what does this system look like? How does it work? And then there was home economics, and people are laughing about that now. But these basic kinds of things that are not taught. And I believe that it's important, particularly for Black people and other oppressed people, to understand the system that we work in, even as we change it. I'm again, Dr. Coringa has this saying, I am realistic, but as for reality, I've come to change it.
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying, well, we got to deal with it, but we're going to change it. I mean, we're not staying in it. And for example, I had a conversation the other day with someone, a radio talk person, and I dropped this piece. And one of my frustrations happens to be, by the way, is some of these things that are just not well known. And so I was telling him, even in a state like Ohio, where that has turned almost deep red, I said, I believe that Black people are still perhaps the margin of difference in that state.
Mm-hmm.
I said, because what a lot of people really do not focus on is that in the United States of America, a large number, I sometimes say the biggest political party is not Democrats, it's not Republicans, it's non-voters. That's a slight overstatement.
Mm-hmm.
But as you well know, Tavis, in terms of the total voting age population, in an election that has 55 to 60% of the United States, the people are jumping up and down. Oh, my God, it was a record.
Oh, yeah.
But if you go to Canada, if you go to England, you go to any European country, that number is 80, 85, 90%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why is that important? What it means is that there are large numbers of white people who do not vote.
Mm-hmm.
It's a low participation environment. In a low participation environment, those who organize and do vote exercise disproportionate power.
Mm.
So in a state, and this is why Jesse Jackson, we talk about why we miss him at this level, because here's what did Jesse used to do? People didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it. Walter Frontway did the same thing. Jesse would go to a state like Ohio, and he would say, okay, there was a senatorial campaign last time against the MAGA guy who won, and I don't know what the numbers are. I'm going to speculate. That race may have been won by 100,000 votes.
Mm-hmm.
Jesse goes to a state like Ohio and he says, let's look at the number of those who are still not registered in the state of Ohio and those who did not vote. And he'll say, not registered in Ohio is still 300,000, 400,000, mm-hmm. 450, a half a million.
Mm-hmm.
The margin of difference is in our hands. Now, I'm not going to blame us for that. You see what I'm saying? I'm not saying we were responsible. But the point is, and what happened really when Trump slipped through in 2016, the Black vote that dipped just a slight percentage in Milwaukee was the margin of difference. So what does that mean in terms of civic education? It means that we need to collectively, not just me by myself, I mean collectively, we ought to be engaging and getting people to understand how this system works and how we can maximize the Black vote. I talk about a formula I used to have. It's a crude, you know, I mean, I call it a 90-99 formula. It's a bit aspirational, but what if we were able to get 90% of Black people registered to vote?
Mm.
And on anyone in any election, get 90% of that 90% to turn out and vote. We would exercise power disproportionate to our numbers. Because let me quickly say this, Tavis. See, what people don't understand is they are befuddled about what happened to the Republican Party. But you know what happened to the Republican Party? And I'd like to, I wish Ron Walter was around to help me out, because he was the more, we was called scholar activists. He was more scholar than activist, me more activist than scholar. Both of us scholar activists, but we need somebody to document this. I do declare, I do believe that Mitch McConnell and the these and that party, by the way, had become conservative. The other day, somebody mentioned, we were talking about Jackie Robinson. I said, oh, yeah, well, Jackie Robinson was a Republican. What? Yeah, Jackie Robinson was a Republican. But he was a Republican. People don't realize that there was once a time when the Republican Party had a liberal wing, a moderate wing, and a conservative wing. It was a more diverse party, and that had implications for what could move forward. But I think in this era, what people heard in the Orange Man, the a.k.a. Agent Orange, white nationalists, grievance-laden white folks. And by the way, we got to deal with their grievance. I mean, I'm not dismissing them as human beings. We got to deal with some of those grievances. Yeah. They heard in Trump a message that they could believe in. They came off the sidelines. These were people who were not voting. The earthquake, what do they call it? The Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. Yeah. And so my contention is they came in and took over the Republican Party.
No, Jesse, I hear your point, and it makes sense. Speaking of Jesse Jackson, Jesse said so many brilliant things, but the thing with regard to this conversation that Jesse said repeatedly, you've heard it more than once, I've heard it more than once, is that as black people, we lose far too many elections by the margin of our absence at the polls. That's quintessential Jesse Jackson, that we lose too many elections by the margin of our absence at the polls. That's Jesse Jackson. He is Dr. Ron Daniels. More with him when we come forward on Tavis Smith.
Hope, agency, dignity. This is Tavis Smiley.
Can you dig it?
Come on!
Ready to re-examine your assumptions and expand your inventory of ideas? More of Tavis Smiley coming your way right now.
Ron Daniels, my time is getting away from me. It's getting really, really tight. But I want to just get a quick word from you. We talked about civic education, one of your laments. The other lament you mentioned was a lack of collaboration amongst black leadership. Say a quick word about that before I move to Haiti, please.
Yeah, well, it's not only among black leadership, it's also in our communities. And to make a long story short, this is one of the things we specialize, frankly, in terms of IBW. And we'll just I'll use one example, criminal justice policy reform, the war on drugs. As we moved and looked at different cities where we had some relationships, we found that people dealing with the same issue, criminal justice policy reform, were not in touch with each other. So what we did in these various cities was create what we call justice collaboratives, in which at least they meet every 3 months. Mm-hmm. And we have other forms, Pan-African Unity Dialogue, the same thing, meeting every 3 or 4 months, so that people at least can exchange information with each other and then create action, joint work action plans off of that. So, and by the way, let me just quickly say that people should go to the website ibw21.org. We really want people to catch up on a lot of what we're doing on Haiti, the follow-up to the Black World, to the State of the Black World Conference. We're on our way to Grenada with a major delegation, and all of the work that we're doing in Haiti, a tremendous amount of work on Haiti that we're doing. And let me just quickly say that we should all be up on Haiti as the world's first black republic, not mm-hmm. in a sentimental way, but because when you go back historically, Haiti gave us back our dignity when we were on our knees. Mm. Because Haiti came to power. It is the only revolution, the Haitian Revolution, where an enslaved people overthrew their slave masters to create an independent nation. Nowhere else in history did that occur. It certainly did not happen with the American Revolution nor the French Revolution. In that sense, you may argue that it is the greatest revolution of all time. The problem is stigmatized, marginalized, because it was not supposed to happen. Mm. They had just put out that it's, you know, if you white, you're all right, yellow, mellow, brown, stick around, and black, get back. Now, they shattered the myth of white supremacy, mm-hmm. and so they've been punished ever since. And so in this most immediate crisis, and you talked about it, keeping your eyes on the prize, I first started doing work in Haiti in 1995. I've been doing work there for now 29 years, mm-hmm. have literally taken hundreds of people to Haiti and have deep relationships there. This crisis did not just start when you saw it explode in the news.
That's right.
Dr. Karinga comes to and has been presented at our Pan-African Unity Diet. We've been monitoring it for a while. And the bottom line is the United States government, in this instance, refused to get rid of or withdraw its support from an illegitimate prime minister, and that ended up in the situation exploding in the way that it is now. But the reason why we're pushing hard on it now, and I'm telling you at the highest levels we're dealing with this, is there is a very promising movement, and Dr. Coringa has had a forum. They came out and they presented to him, at least virtually. It's called the Montana Accord Movement. Why is it so important? Because it has pulled together, for the first time in my experience, a vast majority of the Haitian leadership, civic organizations together, to put forth a plan and a process. And one of the things they're dealing with, they don't want to deal with these fake elections where, you know, you have 15% of the people get elected and come out to vote, and 51% of that becomes the thing. They have a plan and a process that's very powerful. We're supporting that plan and that process. There is some progress now being made, but this is not going to be a short-term process. Yeah. This is going to be over years, and we invite people to help, to work with us to help resolve it.
Our remaining moments, Dr. Ron Daniels, when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
What's your quarrel with the world? You're listening to Tavis Smiley. Who do you trust to get at the truth? Tavis Smiley. That's who. The conversation continues right now.
Dr. Ron Daniels, I got 3 minutes left in this conversation. I want to close by giving it to you for an update on the reparations movement as you see it. One of the issues you've been tracking for many, many years now.
Yeah, it is, and California is helped lead the way, and we have people like Dr. Cheryl Grills, who helped to head up the civic engagement part, which is also a member of the National African American Reparations Commission, who helps to inform us on what is happening with that commission, and they're screening the proposals to make sure that what's really happened is not just ordinary public policy, which is good, but is in fact reparations. The other thing is, I've also been appointed to the New York Reparations Commission. In fact, I've got a Zoom call coming up in a couple of hours with people throughout the region to talk about that development, because one of the important things that's happening is, without question, is that reparations, as my dear beloved sister Nkechi Taiva would say, is on fire. It is moving across the country. Evanston is continuing to develop. That is a project that was certified by the National African American Reparations Commission. Our big challenge right now is at the federal level, which is the major piece, and it is stalled despite having made huge progress in terms of getting co-sponsors and all kinds of efforts that have come. We're pushing Biden to have what we're calling an Emancipation Proclamation moment, and that is to create the H.R. 40 Commission that will study and develop reparations proposals. Not just study, but develop reparations proposals by executive order. He has yet to do that. That is the main target that we're pushing, is to get that over the finish line, we hope, by Juneteenth. And on the global level, by the way, this movement is exploding all over the world. CARICOM Reparations Commission is moving forward. Ghana has now stepped up under President Nadu to provide some global leadership on this question. So as Professor Hilary Beckles has had, and you should get him on sometime, this is the leading public intellectual dealing with reparations. We can certainly help to hook that up. He has said that reparations will be the human rights issue of the 21st century, and it is proving to do so. And so if you want to follow the work of the National African American Reparations Commission, again, you can go to the website ibw21.org. IBW21.org. Really encourage your audience to do that, because that's one of the ways that we can keep people informed even beyond this incredible interview, for which I profoundly thank you and have enjoyed thoroughly.
Dr. Ron Daniels, you're always welcome here, sir. I said earlier that we were going to spend some time in this hour in the Elder Skybox, and we are all the better for it. About to start his 82nd campaign, but still on fire for justice, as you can tell, the IBW's Dr. Ron Daniels. Doc, good to have you on. I'll talk again soon, my friend. All the best to you, sir.
Appreciate it.
Good to have you with us in this hour. In our final hour, we're going to talk about Black composers, an amazing project I want to enlighten you about. So stick around for this last hour of Tavis Smiley.